Actually, the idea of the present paper came out from reading one particular book, and which could be possibly described as one of the most significant works of not just historical musicology, but of medieval scholarship of such as such in recent decade. It could be characterized as such not just because of its really huge size, nearly 700 pages, and weight, it's about 5 kilos, and because this volume was published by a prestigious Yale University Press, whatever. But I think that it could be depicted as such in terms because of the ample material analyzed there and used for it, and for sure because of the years and thousands of hours of research and writing. And also because of its subject, never before explored in such a detail, and at the same time, remarkably vast context of the chosen period of the Western Hemisphere. And what I'm talking about is the extensive volume titled The Christian West and Its Singers, The First Thousand Years, and it was written by Christopher Page, the notable scholar and prominent performer of medieval and early Renaissance music, as well as the founder and director of the Gothic Voices, one of the leading British ensembles of the genre. And as I already mentioned, it was published by Yale University Press in 2010. And as it could be totally grasped, the idea of the book is indicated as a reconstruction of the history of singers, and within wide context of social, political, economic developments. And what I would like to expound further, and it will be not for sure the full-scale review of the book, it's not possible within that limit and of time, and anyway, because it all is a material huge in it. But it rather will be some short glimpses, reflections on this book and on the subject, which by its title already is Christian, the Christian West and Singers. However, what the title in the presentation was already post-Christian Europe, so I think that first of all the question should be raised, and what is post-Christian Europe and post-Christianity in general as such? Or maybe it's more relevant and applicable to talk about post-Christian scholarly discourse. Another issue is that this discourse relevant in dealing with the subject that could be considered as foreign to it, I mean post-Christianity and Christian as such. What question does this discourse raise? Is it applicable? Well, it's to the same research of various topics connected with Christianity. And finally, what knowledge and what objectivity do we gain from this so-called post-Christian discourse? So therefore, maybe first start with the terminology, and later some ideas of historiography, and finally we will turn to certain paragraphs of the book itself. Well, despite the fact that several months ago the British Prime Minister David Cameron declared that the United Kingdom is still a Christian country, the predominant milieu of the Western world of nowadays is more likely and usually to be portrayed as post-Christian one. Just the example presented by our chairman is really a significant one, when the people in East Germany don't know what Christmas is and what it is for. Not having enough time to go into detail of the proper meaning of this term, I would like to present just a few insights of that post-Christian scholarly discourse deals with. Usually it's actually much more in general religious studies, but it can be, let's say, bioethics, whether our mentality in bioethics is still Christian or post-Christian. There are just some topics that I have searched through while Googling the internet. Let's say gender studies and feminist theory, particularly in connection with theology or whatever, or just studies, what feminist theory, what Carl Gibson and whatever, let's just tell that proper. I mean, it might be studies of Shintoism, of Islam in Europe and whatever, and dealing with post-Christianity in Europe and so on. Well, once again, such strange topic as post-Christian Christian theology, post-Christian Catholic theology, whatever, it's really a title like that. For me, it sounds a little bit crazy, but whatever, it is like that. And many other things could be possibly from anthropology to social sciences and so on. So let's go and try to define. The first thing, how I try to define it is a kind of postmodern thinking in which Christian religion, as well as an other religion possibly, is considered as a type of historical psychological phenomenon, no more relevant for the mainstream contemporary thinking and knowledge. Another thing I think it's possible also to describe as that post-Christianity depicts the present-day highly secularized Western society, or rather Europe, and so that's the type of the European civilization, because Western Hemisphere, European civilization is really much more spread all over the world. And it's secularized in which the system and code of Christian values as such are considered as the unnecessary remnants of the past. It is worth to say, or as a kind of respectful heritage which still possesses some merit, its best. And I think in any case, in both cases, these values are not considered any more relevant in scholarly discourse. Another thing, it is also true even dealing with the subject that normally should be understood as Christian, let's say. Finally, the term post-Christianity might also be used as a synonym or substitute for massive secularization of the Western society, speaking in relation to religious practices. So it's the quotation from Simon Coleman, who was Jose Casanova, that Western societies seem to have undergone rapid, drastic, and seemingly irreversible processes of secularization, a kind of post-Christianity in the sense that an increasing majority of the population has ceased regular participation in traditional religious practices. Actually, one more interesting thing is that post-Christianity somehow is connected with the post-secular age as well, because recent articles that I have found namely deals with post-secular age in Western society. So, and here I would like to now turn to historiographical thinking, because it's also what is important in dealing with the subject and dealing with the book as itself. So that means, first of all, is what is important is that opposition of past and present in any historical writing is this opposition is a central one, I think, and distinction is something wrong. As Jacques Legoff once put it, the distinction between past and present, made both of common consciousness and by the historian, is seldom neutral. For some, the past is a golden age, an exemplary time of innocence and virtue, and the epoch of great ancestors. Further, it is barbarism, archaism, the lair of obsolete and outdated antiques, and epoch of physical and mental wars. As for present, it is in corollary fashion either the blessed age of progress, creativity, and civilization, or else a dangerous time of thoughtless innovations and lamentable age of decline. Well, both variants could be met anyway. So, in other words, our thinking about the past never always goes side by side with our thinking about our present. It's as if looking to the past through the spectacles like these of the present. And here I would like just to mention and quote another prominent musicologist, Leo Traitler, in his thoughtful book Music and the Historical Imagination. First of all, he's talking about two different modes, let's say, of historical thinking. First, and as he notes, that the historian usually faces a certain dilemma between two approaches. The first one, which is called diachronic mode, is based on the desire to explain the past through attention to questions of origins, influence, trends, movements, development. The general form of such questions is how or why did the past come to be as it was? The general form of answers is such as to represent the past as the likely or necessary consequence of antecedent conditions. And in this case, that principle mode of thinking is really, as it's described, to think of the past as prehistory of the present and the present as consequence of the past. Another mode, according to him, is a synchronic mode, which is inspired by searching for knowledge of the past in its individuality and its particularity. And for itself, is the question is, as it really was, so to say. How historians are more inclined to ask what and why, and in seeking answers, they aim to stop the past in its tracks and hold it still as though it were a present. Actually, this presentness is one of the important issues in this mode of thinking. As Treitel puts it, the presentness is the leading category for knowing the objects of history and this way of thinking. Well, I think it's also connected to a certain aspect with this maybe second mode, is dealing with the past and with the history of the past, the object of the past as some distant, as something other. And this otherness is also presented at a kind, let's say, as foreign, strange to us. This other us, another opposition. And in this case, looking to that otherness is as if looking to something different from us and not closely related to us. One of the most interesting may be this past as other definitions that I found explained by Peter Jeffrey. To see the past less as a precursor of our own period and more as a distinct culture existing of itself and intelligible on its own terms. And sorry, it's misspelling. Namely, that means object of its own and really, in this case, as if not very much in connection with ourselves. And to summarize that all historical thinking, let's turn to Leo Treitel once again in his elegant phrasing, that the discourse of history can appear as a medium of proud self-portraiture, as the ritual of a culture in narcissistic self-contemplation, and opening history to anthropological as well as historiographical description, in which, let's say, ideological attitudes, needs, and ambitions are very much at work. And, well, now let's turn to name the Christian West and its singers. And first, let's turn to Christopher Page himself, who defines the theme of his research in the following terms. I have no ambition to engage with the Carolingian or any other cultural period as a whole, but I have endeavored to place the history of singers, a history of singers, insofar as it is can be reconstructed in the context of social, political, and economic developments. The evidence relating to Christian ritual singers in the first millennium is intelligible only in relation to a wide panorama of social, political, economic, and linguistic context, in addition to the many liturgical issues that have been much studied in the past, where I must bow to the experts. What I would like to stress, namely, in addition to liturgical issues, let's say, one, it could be considered as some kind of religious context, with is significant, to my opinion, dealing with such object as this, is not mentioned at all, and liturgical issues is a kind of representative of that religious context. This is even more striking, I think, that it's a religious context, let's say, just a religious object, as of the book is, namely, when we look to the contents, we see everything is actually dealing with, namely, church singers, not let's say, secular singers. There were, for sure, in medieval times, and that first millennia, it is known, it's enough to check, let's say, whatever significant handbook, like the New Register of Music and so on, you will find descriptions and serious consideration, it's also evidence for that, that there were also secular singers, but what he is talking about is namely religious church musicians. And therefore we don't have anything from the religious context as such, according to Christopher Page. And this is, I think, even more striking because the sources he's working with, well, once again to repeat, it's a huge amount of them, chronicles, lives of saints, in this case, hagiography, which, also it has to do with religious context as such, letters, charters, epigraphy, one of the important and interesting issues that he takes into consideration. So, let's say this premises, and now let's turn to certain keywords or key issues, key topics and points that he uses. Once again, I'm not presenting here the full review, just few glimpses. So one item that he is really, that Christian Page deals with, and I think this is a really important one and interesting one, is that of communications. That according to Christopher Page, this was not just the principal method of the new religion, Christianity in the first centuries AD. To spread throughout the ancient world, but also one of the main reasons it did and succeeded in that. First of all, already in the land of origin of Christianity is seen as a certain center of communications. Christianity did not arise in an obscure corner, misspelling once again, of the empire, but in a region with minimal distance connections that carried an Asian religion and an Asian material culture washed deep into Europe, while communications, in this case, is a central issue. That communications is a central issue was also described in that how it spread, and namely that Christianity was the faith of the port cities and the immediate hinterlands or cities on major rivers, and that his main point is really that due to communications, and then because of these communications, Christianity raises such. But another important point in all this dealing is power and material culture. This really one of the most important issues that he's dealing with, could be traced throughout the book. This issue of power and material culture instead, or not in addition to, let's say, to divine revelation and authority, which should have been one of the major fonts of that same spread of religion and also the inspiration for how the religious ritual, and religious ritual is also of huge importance for the singers, because due to that ritual, the singers developed as such. They appeared as such. So in this case, the essence and aim of religious ritual is considered to be as a device and of spreading power and wealth, not of religion, it's religion itself. As Christopher Page put it, liturgy and worship spelled Roman material culture and insignia of power surely as the dyed silken cloaks and other costly garments that the Eastern Romans used as diplomatic bargaining counters in their dealings with the Western kings. And in this case, what we have, the games of power are really of key importance, since the worship should be regulated in order to transmit that material culture as well as this worldly power. And it appears to be the main factors that the church singers, or at least one of the main factors, that the church singers as such, or rather the viscera of a liturgical singer started to materialize. As he puts, in the new political order of kings, singers were answerable to the bishops whom the kings vowed for their amanitas. The master of good Latin, including perhaps the ability to write a fine letter poem along with my family history, in the region where the king had to come to rule, etc., etc. And the literature that the singer served in an island of material opulence was linked with the Roman social order that the kings inherited and valued as miniature Constantines, and so on and so forth. Another issue is already, this could be power material culture, but also already some kind of social structure and social culture. It also turns to another important issue that Christopher Page is also dealing with, as Roman household, and as seen as a basis of social structure and also as a basis of arising the Christian religion. And another, and the last not the least, is really the table and food culture. Why am I stressing this? Maybe it's kind of for myself, it was the best when I wrote it. It's really a kind of unexpected term, but what Christopher Page tells about, basing, well, once again, on the Gospel, by the way, is that the history of Christianity during its first 3 centuries is in many respects the story of who was prepared to sit down at table, with whom to enjoy nature's bounty, in a good year, and give thanks for it. Just sitting around, having a good party, and so on. Even in these terms, or less likely like that, he also talking about the central act of Christian worship, which is Eucharist. The issue is, and as if the issue is reduced to simple meal and pleasant company. Of course, it's an exaggeration to a certain extent, because Christopher Page is dealing really with huge amount of sources and complicating issues, attempting to trace echoes of Christian music, and also he develops plausible methodology of 4 steps in analyzing literary sources used for singing during the first centuries in Christian communities, and this methodology is as such. The first is to keep the diversity of early Christian meals at the front of the mind. The second is to relax the distinction between sources identified only in a later period as canonical or as apocryphal writings. The third step is to recognize the diversity of doctrine that could exist even within the mainstream church. The fourth and final step is to investigate all the sources material gain in case anything of potential value has escaped. Well, you can find it's really a good methodology and really well based, but still those all first reflections and your first impression on that communications power material culture is really very much a place even throughout the book and throughout the book. Okay, so now I am going to some conclusions already. let's summarize like that. The approach with the history of music, Christian music and musicians of the first millennium AD, as depicted by Christopher Page in Christopher Page books, could be considered as one of the prevailing modes of contemporary scholar discourse, combining those above mentioned modes of dealing with past, present, or position. The moving point behind it is really clearly that of post-Christian thinking, which at its best could be described as emerging from agnosticism and relativism. I could quote once again that, because of time I will not. Third, it might be also described as assertion of strictly scholarly, scientific form of objectivity, which, well, once again, according to Leo Tretiakov, is the attitude that in knowing we are guided by the qualities of what is presented to the mind and by reason, and we allow neither apprehension nor judgment to be colored by the state of our minds and feelings. However, this post-Christianity objectivity, however, is lacking namely certain aspects. it's really taking a position because of that minds of feelings on certain ideological bias, I think. And finally, the post-Christian approach, of course it is present, it's impossible writing, but his writing, History of Christian Music, called Certain Limits, which the same attitude does not permit to overcome. Therefore, this application should be also considered as limited and not fully revealing the matter such. So, that's all.
So, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Please.
Thank you very much. Did I understand? I haven't read the book yet. But you point out these three methodologies, two from Leo Trinklad, one from Peter Jeffrey, and you said that Page's book is a scholarly approach. And at the end you said that he's combining all these three methodologies. So isn't there a little contradiction? Because it seems that Page always fits his ideas and uses different methodologies. And as you said, it's a 5-kilo real brick. It looks very scholarly. But how do you think, is it actually scholarly?
Well, if we... talking about solar apparatus as such, it's there. So from that point of view, it's absolutely solid. What I told, maybe it's not that methodology, but maybe that's those modes, what I was talking about, he still deals as if with that past, much more like object in itself, but deals from the point of a view of present day. This was my point. Namely, present day, not that day, that as it could be. Therefore, if he dealt with that object, also thinking about the way how these people thought, the religious context should be there for sure. Otherwise, it's unthinkable in that first millennium, for sure, in dealing with the church musicians and such.
Martin?
Yeah, I have some critical remarks.
Yes, thanks.
I think I don't like this term post-Christian. I have studied theology myself in East Germany. And for the East German church, the situation was described as a diaspora, not as post-Christian. And that is the way even the Catholic Church uses the term for Europe today. Second thing is, it's really highly Eurocentric to say post-Christian. There have never been so many Christian leaders like today. Look to Korea or Africa or whatever. And even in the most regions of the world, you can find missionaries now. Third thing is... I think if you talk about scholarly agnosticism in church music or church history writing, that is a reality since 200 years, I would say. Just remember that a city in Berlin 200 years ago already had a population which consisted of 70% of non-baptized people. 70%, I mean, the vast majority. And the fourth thing I would say, if I deal with something like medieval music or something such remote from my world, the gap cannot be filled between that, no matter if I'm a believer or not, I think. So I think this post-Christian term is not very appropriate.
The problem is that this term is used as such, and if, of course, it's Europe's interest, for sure, but we're dealing with object that is from European civilization, not world civilization. And this is why I used it, and maybe it's using with a question mark, should be, for sure. but it's of course always difficult to deal with the material that is 1,000 years old, as such, in this case, for sure. But what my point is really that this mentality, which could be described really as post-Christian, because they used to describe it as such, really lacks something. And the something is that, once again, that context of religion, that, for instance, in this huge brick, we don't find. Or find in rather strange terms. Because, well, once again, there are some other wonderful books like James MacKinnon, the Advent Project, also dealing with the first century, so meaning from the 7th, 8th century, well, interesting biohypothesis. And he deals with, let's say, the music itself, but also deals with the musicians of Schola Cantorum Romana, let's say. But he does not exclude that context, and that the arguments he provides are much more plausible. This was my point.
Are there any questions left? Short question?
Do you like the book?
Yes. I like because it's really huge. I mean, it has a lot of material in itself. Some conclusion that it provides. I really don't. Yes.
Thank you for this question. And once more, thank you, Jonas.